I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Diane Nissenbaum, a very special guest who is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. He's an award-winning reporter who covers U.S. policy in the Middle East and regional security for The Wall Street Journal. During his career, Diane's been based in Kabul, Beirut, Jerusalem, Washington, and Istanbul. He joins us today after doing some really extensive reporting on the situation in Israel. Diane, thanks so much for sparing some time. I know you're a busy guy these days.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So tell me first, today, your colleagues, we're talking on December 12th, your colleagues in the Wall Street Journal, Nancy Youssef and Michael Gordon and others, are reporting that Israel has begun pumping seawater into the tunnels in northern Gaza. This is a tactic first used by Egypt to close tunnels that ran from Gaza into Egypt. What are you seeing on the ground, you know, as you've been reporting, and what is the reporting your colleagues are telling us? What does this mean for this next phase of the war?
The tunnels, which the Israelis refer to as the Gaza Metro, is hundreds of miles of tunnels. And as much as Israel is gaining control above ground, they really need to gain control below ground, which is where a lot of these Hamas fighters are holding out. It's extensive. They have massive rooms down there and ventilation. And it's believed that also there are Israeli hostages down there. And for the first few weeks of the ground invasion, Israel was being quite deliberate in not going into the tunnels to avoid being caught in traps. That's a very difficult situation to fight in. They also didn't want to necessarily endanger any Israeli hostages who might be down there. And so now, as they're gaining control of the north above ground, they're trying to figure out what to do about gaining control below ground. And the pumping water into these tunnels is a way that they can avoid putting their forces at risk and also potentially address sort of flushing them out, literally drowning them. The question, I think, is still outstanding is, what does that mean for hostages that may be held below ground? And they must have made some assessment that the hostages in the north are not below ground.
Yeah, I mean, this is uncharted territory too, right? Because this is the first real subterranean war, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why, the Israelis have avoided going into these tunnels, because it's claustrophobic, there's no way to maneuver. They don't really know the dynamics underground. So, yeah, it is a different kind of war.
Yeah, I've seen it said by, the Israelis and military experts that, you don't know. First of all, you have to go in a lot of these places single file. Second of all, there's IEDs, there's other kinds of booby traps. There are, certainly Hamas fighters lurking. And then, of course, the problem that you mentioned, the hostages are there and, the goal is to get them out. So this presents just an incredibly difficult task for the Israelis, doesn't it?
It is an incredibly difficult task. And they've said quite publicly that one of their goals here is to put more pressure on Hamas militarily to force them back to the negotiating table to see if they can get the rest of the hostages out. So, their goal here is to, inflict as much damage, weaken them sufficiently so that they can drive them back to the negotiating table. And the war aims of the Israeli government are slightly blurry and shifting. And so, this call for the destruction of Hamas has somewhat shifted more to a destruction of their ability to, again, carry out another October 7th type attack. So you're seeing, a modern military wrestle with the issues that America has dealt with in other fronts in terms of going into a place all gung-ho with an agenda and then realizing you've got to be a little more realistic about your end game and trying to figure out an exit strategy.
Yeah, the American parallels are striking. And yet, one of the things that we're all seeing, and these are horrific images, is of, Palestinian civilian suffering. And Israel says it's trying to minimize any kind of civilian suffering, but that suffering in this kind of conflict is inevitable. What are the Israelis saying now as the situation grows more dire in Gaza, both north and south?
Well, they say the same thing, you know, that they are trying to minimize civilian casualties. I think everybody is, you know, disturbed by the images that we're seeing of children and the chaotic situation in these hospitals. Every day, you know, there's another tragedy. I've spoken with a number of former U.S. military officials who ran the wars in, against ISIS and Afghanistan and, you know, Al-Qaeda. And, you know, they talk about the parallels with 9/11 and how, you know, after 9/11, America had this push for revenge. And that was, there was sort of a, you know, a revenge element to the U.S. strategy after that, which, you know, led to some disastrous consequences in Iraq. And they see kind of these same parallels with Israel, you know, the, because the goals are so expansive, because they are talking about destroying Hamas, it means that the campaign itself is so expansive, which means that so many more civilians die because their goals are so expansive. So even if they're trying to minimize civilian casualties, because they're in the process of destroying Hamas's ability to govern and also its military capabilities, that it's hitting everywhere, especially since, you know, Hamas doesn't have a, you know, a defense headquarters that you hit, doesn't have a Pentagon. You know, they're in apartments and houses and everywhere and in the tunnels under all of these homes. So civilian casualties are so high because the Israeli goals are so expansive.
You know, a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, I had retired Brigadier General Asaf Orion, who is in the reserves, who I believe you've spoken with and know. When I asked him about this and about these expansive goals, he said, you know, we have no choice. If we want to live in this neighborhood, if we want to live in Israel, we have to dismantle or eliminate Hamas. And that seems to be the line that they've continued to take. They haven't wavered from that, have they?
No, not at all. And, you know, he was the Israeli general that was responsible for negotiations in the north, dealing with the northern border with Hezbollah. And, you know, he's been warning about the threat from the north as well. And, you know, they, one of the things that you see in Israel now is that, you know, the psyche has changed there after October 7th. They were humiliated. They were shocked. The attack by Hamas, who was kind of seen as the weak link, you know, this group that was deterred, carried out this incredible attack. I was down there, you know, 2 days after the attack. You could see the scope of it. It was just remarkable how far and wide and long they were able to carry this out. And, you know, the aura of invincibility that Israel has projected for decades was shattered. And they are now trying to reclaim that by carrying out this expansive operation and trying to, you know, pummel Hamas. But they also do have to address what they see is actually the bigger problem in the north from Hezbollah. So the U.S. has tried to discourage them from opening a second front, but there continues to be a lot of push for Israel to turn its attention to the north once they get a handle on Gaza, whenever that is.
Yeah, let's talk about the north. You know, your recent reporting has, you know, said that Israel has over 100,000 soldiers deployed to the north, and that the threat is the Radwan force in Hezbollah. Tell us what that is and what that means and why Israel has to be so concerned with it.
So one of the things you'll hear Israelis say, both civilians that live up there and the leaders, is that the plan that Hamas used for crossing the border and carrying out these massacres was actually developed by Hezbollah. And, you know, Hezbollah was the one that was digging tunnels under the border. They were the ones developing these kinds of plans. So, you know, the Israelis have lived out there. They've been evacuated from the border out of this fear that there's going to be an October 7th style attack. And these elite Radwan forces that Hezbollah has are the ones that are trained to carry that out. And the Israelis say that these forces have, you know, moved close to the border, and that's the big fear, that they are going to try and carry out a similar type attack. And a lot of these people that live up there are not going to be willing to return to their homes if they think that that threat is real.
And we're talking about tens of thousands of Israelis in the north. And this is Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, Israeli Druze, Bedouin, et cetera, who have, you know, had to evacuate their homes that are now in the center of the country. And just like the residents of the south after October 7th, who also had to move to the center of the country, Hamas and Hezbollah has effectively shrunken Israel, which is part of their goal. Their goal is to eliminate Israel, and now they've shrunken it.
Yeah, exactly. There's, you know, estimated 80 to 100,000 civilians that have been evacuated from the north. And, you know, I've been up there a couple of times. I covered the 2006 war from up there from the Israeli side. And I went back to talk to a lot of the people that I met up there, Israelis who, you know, were quite steadfast and didn't leave their homes in 2006. And now they're quite rattled and shaken, and they're fearful of going back. And I think that's the fundamental question for Israel here is, you know, can they get a handle on Gaza? Can they come up with an exit strategy? Can they maintain sufficient international support to then turn their attention to the north? There was a big push early in the war in Gaza from some top leaders like the defense minister to strike Hezbollah, basically carry out a two-front war. Netanyahu himself was sort of reluctant. They want to do it now sequentially, but what does that mean? So they keep threatening to do to Lebanon what they're doing to Gaza as a way to try and drive Hezbollah sort of to the negotiating table. After the 2006 war, there was a UN resolution 1701 that is supposed to keep Hezbollah forces, you know, 18 miles away from the Israel border. And that's really not been honored very well. The UN force up there is really not capable of enforcing it. And so the Israelis are trying to figure out if they can basically deter Hezbollah and force them to push those forces back without having to launch a second front.
And so far, Israel hasn't done anything preemptively. They've shot back after Hezbollah has shot at them. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically. So, you know, there's this unofficial, unspoken sort of ladder of escalation for the Israelis and Hezbollah, where, you know, it's basically tit for tat. So Hezbollah hits, you know, something small, Israel will hit back at something small, and they won't hit back, you know, north of this Litani River, about 18 miles north. Everything is within these parameters. And, you know, Hezbollah has started using larger missiles now, but they haven't used these precision guided missiles that they have capable of hitting Tel Aviv. All of their hits have been close to the border. So everything is sort of within this, you know, rubric, within this ladder of escalation. But, you know, you talk to Israeli officials and they say, you know, we're one miscalculation away from, you know, full on war.
So let's talk about that for a second. In 2006, the war between Israel and Hezbollah raged on for 34 days, I believe. And in that war, Israel set Hezbollah back considerably, so much so that they haven't come back at Israel in any real way since then. Now they seem to be contemplating it. And what are their capabilities now versus then?
The biggest concern for Israel is these tens of thousands of precision guided missiles that they've been building with Iranian support, capable of carrying out, you know, targeted attacks on Israel. You know, they've got tens of thousands of these rockets and missiles capable of hitting Israel. It's a much bigger threat, and it would require a much bigger response from Israel. You know, there are estimates that, you know, Hezbollah could fire 3,000 missiles a day. And that's another reason why Israel doesn't want to have a two-front war, because they do have limited and strained air defenses that are not capable of protecting Israel from that kind of daily onslaught. So they have to calculate the risks to the civilian population. You know, they need to figure out what kind of war strategy they could have that would take it out. You know, the Israeli threats almost, you know, weekly, if not daily, are that, you know, we will send Lebanon back into the Stone Age if you launch this war. And, you know, they're basically vowing to carry out, you know, an even worse kind of air campaign in Lebanon than they are doing in Gaza.
And is that, so far, it's been enough of a deterrent, but does Israel actually think and believe that they can fight a two-front war at the same time of this magnitude?
They have said that they could, but, you know, you have seen, I think, a shift from, you know, doing it in parallel to trying to do it sequentially. So, and you also have, you know, U.S. pressure here. The U.S. has sent two carrier strike groups and a nuclear submarine to the region, all to send a message to Hezbollah that don't get into this fight. And the U.S. is very concerned about this becoming a regional war. And, you know, they've actually not been too successful in preventing that, because you've got these, you know, Houthi missiles that the U.S. military is having to shoot down in the Red Sea already. So, you know, if you look at it broadly, you know, from the Iranian perspective, Hezbollah decided not to get involved, but the Houthis are getting involved, and they actually are posing, you know, a pretty significant threat here. Surprisingly, they're sort of the surprise entry into the conflict that's forced the U.S. to get directly involved militarily.
You know, at the outset of this, my colleague at CSIS, Norm Rule, said the Houthis are primed to jump into this, and you know, my response was, the Houthis don't have water, they don't have food, they don't have power. How on earth do they have ballistic missiles capable of hitting targets in Israel and around Israel? How is that?
Yeah. I know Norm well, and you know, I appreciate he's got, you know, a lot of on the ground experience in that part of the world, and I remember talking to him actually about this, you know, years ago when Netanyahu was warning about missile threats from the Houthis. And I remember kind of being skeptical, saying, they've got Hezbollah right there. Like, you know, if Iran wants someone to fire missiles, they'll have Hezbollah do it. But, you know, as we're seeing, Hezbollah's deterred. They don't want Israel to turn its military focus on them. Yemen is far away. Iran spent a lot of time providing them with missile and drone capabilities that they used, you know, to carry out years of attacks on Saudi Arabia. And they've had this stockpile of weapons that they're now using to try and hit Israel. It's remarkable.
Let me ask you about this. President Biden has been warning that Israel is losing its support over this war with Hamas. Do you think it matters to the Israelis that they may be losing support?
I think it matters to them for sure. They do need especially American support. That rhetoric just changed today, really, with the president coming out and saying this so bluntly. But for right now, you know, you see the Biden administration fast-tracking the delivery of artillery shells to Israel and sending them bunker buster bombs. So, you know, if you look at what's happening in reality versus the rhetoric, Israel is still getting the support it needs from the U.S. Because the Israeli psyche has changed so significantly, I do think, you know, if push comes to shove and they feel like they're getting backed into a corner and they're losing international support, but that their aims of being able to deter their adversaries in the region have not been met, I don't think that they will hold their fire. I think they will continue to pursue them as far as they think they need to go to sort of reestablish themselves and their, you know, their aura of invincibility, and to convey to everybody in the region that they're not going to allow October 7th to happen again.
Yeah. And despite President Biden's remarks today, the Wall Street Journal poll came out yesterday and showed that a majority of Americans believe what Israel's doing is justified.
Right.
So, you know, there's that. But clearly, this war has a way to go before it unwinds itself, both, you know, and with Hamas, but then, you know, of course, with these other threats that we've been talking about. Are people that you're talking to in your reporting, are they voicing any sort of optimism for an end game?
I don't. That was the wisest advice that Biden gave to Netanyahu was at the very beginning of this, which was, you know, look at what happened to America after 9/11. Think through your strategy before you go in. Have an exit strategy. And they basically said, screw it. We have to go in and we'll think about the day after later. And there is no exit strategy. There is you know, from what I can see, it's pretty clear, and even the Israelis say so, that they're planning for months, if not years, of effective military occupation there. You know, not necessarily Israeli troops patrolling in Gaza City, but Israeli troops having full security control of the Gaza Strip for years on end. And nobody has an idea of who's going to be providing the day-to-day security in Gaza City. The place is being demolished. It's basically being turned into a massive refugee camp. And you have to rebuild it. Nobody can agree on who should run it, whether it's the Palestinian Authority or some local new Gaza authority that's loosely connected to the Palestinian Authority. The U.S. wants them connected. Netanyahu doesn't want them connected. The U.S. and Israel would like Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Egypt and Jordan to basically oversee the creation of a new security force and the government there. None of those countries are very eager to do so. They're going to have to be pushed into it if they're going to do it at all. You know, who's going to lead Gaza? These are all questions that are still unanswered, and there's no agreement on any of it.
Yeah, you know, and Jordan, Egypt, Qatar, et cetera, you know, don't seem to have any willingness for taking on any of the residents of Gaza into their countries to help absorb them either. And, you know, a lot of people in the United States are wondering why not. What are you hearing on that?
Well, you know, for Palestinians themselves, like, you know, there's a fear, you know, that this is 1948 all over again. This is what they see as Palestinian land was supposed to be part of a Palestinian state, and forcing them to leave, you know, shatters their dreams of having a Palestinian state. You know, Jordan for years took in Palestinian refugees and dealt with the instability created by that. Sisi in Egypt is you know, drawn a pretty strong red line on this. He's not willing to allow Palestinians in because of the fear of the instability that would create for him domestically. You know, where would you put them? You know, it's desert on the other side. So, you know, bringing in large numbers of Palestinians has a risk of creating more instability in all of these neighboring countries.
Diane, I want to ask you, constantly people are asking me, how are reporters covering this war in an age of such misinformation? I had a reporter come to me with a shocking request yesterday. He said that he was fact-checking a claim that was floating around on social media that said Israelis actually murdered their own people on October 7th. And would we at CSIS help him with the fact-checking on that? And my response was, I couldn't even believe that any serious reporter was taking a claim like that seriously. What's it like to be covering this war amidst, you know, this kind of environment?
Well, that example is interesting because I have been told, and I believe that it is true, that Israeli forces in responding to the Hamas attacks did kill some of Israeli civilians in that response. It's a small number, and this is sort of where it gets caught up in the misinformation, because, you know, there were helicopters that were responding, providing close air support for soldiers on the ground and shooting at everybody. And there were some Israelis that were apparently killed by Israeli forces as they tried to get things under control in that chaotic situation. That has been, you know, embraced by the conspiracy theorists as, you know, the idea that Israel killed more people than Hamas did on that day, which is, you know, patently absurd on its face. And so that's an interesting example because there is a nugget of truth in that, but it's been embraced by, you know, these conspiracy theorists and a lot of people to suggest something that isn't there. And, you know, we've had this discussion at the Journal about whether or not to do a story about this to try and explain what happened on that day. And it's still an open question. But this is, you know, what you have to try and do is report out the facts, put them in context, explain what has happened. I'm doing that every day. Like I'm working on a story now about several babies that were left behind at a hospital in Gaza when they were ordered to evacuate by the Israeli military. And, you know, because we don't have direct access to Gaza, you know, it's closed by the Israelis and Egypt. And our reporter is not able to report safely there himself. He's only able to get around Rafah. Trying to understand the facts is incredibly difficult. It's a fog of war. There's a lot of misinformation. People are, you know, reporting in from war zones. It's incredible. It's difficult to report.
Yeah, I mean, and in the case of the Israelis who were killed by, you know, friendly fire, I suppose you could call it, on October 7th, the context is that Israel, you know, it was an accident that they were killed. It wasn't something purposeful like the conspiracy theorists are saying, you know, and using that as, you know, that Israel killed people to fake the world into thinking they could go and then, you know, wreak havoc in Gaza. It's just absurd.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, I think these are the most challenging kinds of disinformation efforts that are hard to push back against, because there are, you know, kernels of truth to these things that people can latch onto. I had a friend of mine, in fact, the other night asked me this question at a dinner. You know, she was seeing stuff on social media and asking me this, exactly this question. And so you can see how far and wide these kinds of things get. And trying to provide facts on this kind of stuff is difficult. Because we don't actually know, nobody's done the reporting on this to understand it. There was a Haaretz story that came out on this, actually, that was based on a police report saying that, you know, Israeli helicopters had killed these people. And then the police themselves came out with a statement saying that this was wrong and that it was incorrect. But, you know, Haaretz is a leading Israeli newspaper, respected, does good work. And, you know, if they're the ones that are publishing this, it's going to go far and wide, and it did before, you know, the police could come back and try and set the record straight. And, you know, it's an ongoing struggle.
You know, finally, I want to ask you, the political situation in Israel has been fraught leading up into this. There are certainly calls for Benjamin Netanyahu to resign. He's not buying it. He's not listening to those calls. What are you seeing in the political situation now? Is there a unity until this is resolved, or do you think Netanyahu's leadership could unravel?
Well, this is definitely my personal perspective, is that I'm not sure that I see Netanyahu's downfall necessarily in the cards here. He has a right-wing government whose members understand that if they bring this government down, they won't return to power. So they have an incentive to keep him there. There's no obvious candidate in Netanyahu's own party, Likud, to replace him and take over. I think you're going to see a lot of resignations on the military side. Top military officials, intelligence officials are going to have to resign once these wars are over, once the war is over, to take responsibility for what happened. Netanyahu has said he's not going to resign. He's not going to fall on his sword. The most interesting kind of dynamic we're seeing right now is sort of the pressure from the released hostages and their families, who are quite angry at the way he's prosecuting the war. And they want him to negotiate and get these people out and, you know, not just continue to bomb Gaza. There have been reports that some of these bombings have killed Israeli hostages. Not clear if that's true or not. But I think the hostage families, you know, are sort of the ones that could potentially lead public protests that might force Netanyahu to resign when this is all over, depending on how this all ends up. If Netanyahu is able to end this war with, you know, most of these hostages freed and, you know, Hamas significantly deterred, you know, he may have an argument to stay on in power. You know, everybody refers to him as the magician, right? He's been counted out so many times before. And I think this is another time when people shouldn't count him out.
Dayan, thank you so much for your time today and for the excellent reporting you're doing for The Wall Street Journal. I really appreciate your insight.
Thank you. Great to be here.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.